This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. For the past 20 years, Michael Eisner has been the corporate face of Disney. He first took over as chief executive officer of the Walt Disney Company in 1984, at a time when the company was still searching for direction after the death of its legendary founder, Walt Disney. During his first decade at the top, Eisner helped turn the company around with landmark mergers and movie hits, achievements which set him on the road to becoming one of the most powerful names in the entertainment industry. The last 10 years, though, have been marked by changes, to say the least. Public spats with fellow executives, economic woes after September 11th, and a shareholder revolt, and an unsolicited takeover. He's currently scheduled to step down as CEO on September 30th of this year. After more than two decades at the helm in this very competitive industry, Eisner says the best of what he knows about leadership didn't come from corporate seminars, but from around the campfire at his childhood summer camp. And he's now written a book about it. This hour, we're talking with Michael Eisner about his tenure at Disney, about what it's like to be at the top, how to stay there, and how camp had everything to do with that. Later, we'll take a look into the future of the Canadian Parliament's gay marriage legislation. But now, if you have a question for Michael Eisner about Disney, questions about leadership, questions about summer camp, you can join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email address TOTN@NPR.org. Michael Eisner joins us now from the studios of NPR West. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So you're the head of Disney. It's being on top of the entertainment industry. That's known as a cutthroat industry. It takes leadership skills. It takes a lot of skill to stay there for 20 years. And I suppose people would be surprised to hear that camp is what gave you, as far as you're concerned, the skill to do it. Tell us about
well,
that.
Well, I wouldn't characterize the entertainment industry as cutthroat.
No?
I mean, no. I mean, it's no different than any other business, actually. Most of the people you deal with in the entertainment business are very positive and straightforward. So that kind of is a myth about about the entertainment business. But nevertheless, I've been in it for 40 years and I've had a lot of fun over that time dealing with movies and television and theme parks and Broadway theater and stuff like that. And yes, many things, you know, go into your background to make you what you are. And one of the things for me that was very important, you know, besides family and college and nursery school, was camp, which I wrote about.
Tell us about Camp Key Wadin. Am I saying that right, by the way? Key Wadin?
Perfectly. It was interesting. Your audio clip from earlier was something that I was on NPR 4 years ago, so I recognize that I've been talking about this for quite a while. The camp I went to is the boys' part of Key Wadin. There is a girls' camp as well. The oldest camp in America, specializing in tripping, canoe tripping, hiking, wilderness tripping, team building, and all those things that help you figure out how to be a team player, to help, kind of a cliche they say, helping the other fellow. But it all goes toward the whole is better than any individual member. And the camp happened to have a kind of a parallel universe to what later I found at Disney, which is a respect for the individual, respect for the environment, all of which was founded, you know, in the 1890s. So it's not a new idea, it's just a very valid idea.
Well, you know, you say that, and you talk about the corporate environment, Disney not being any different than any other corporation, or the entertainment industry, I guess, to be fair, is what we said, wasn't really different than any other industry in the United States. And that is to say that corporations really are not in the business to promote values as much as they'd like to. They can't. They really, you know, having been in a stockholder fight, if you're not turning profit, then you're not doing your job. Got nothing to do with values.
Well, of course, I don't agree with that either. The way you turn a profit, in my opinion, especially at Disney, is you respect values. You do things better. You do things excellently. You make better movies, better television shows. The Disney Company, yes, we've had contentious family, you know, second generations of family companies tend to, as they do in all industries, become fractious, as you said in the opening. Disney has never had an accounting issue, a issue of wrong dealing. It's always run an ethical point of view. It's never had a big write-off. You know, you mentioned the last 10 years have been more difficult than the first 10 years. Well, we had tremendous growth in the first 10 years, but the last 10 years, we've built theme parks all over the world. We've had major hit movies, Broadway shows, The Lion Kings, and all those kinds of things. It is a misconception about Disney, but it's also a misconception about the entertainment business. I found from the moment I joined ABC in my 20s that everybody that dealt was of their word because there was so much activity. And I found when I went to Paramount in the late in the middle 70s that that a little bit less so, but still extremely honorable people dealing in honorable ways. When I got into Disney and we got into some things in the real estate business and some things that were more typical of industry, I found it a little less, frankly, cutthroat than the entertainment business. People have a very strange conception of the entertainment business because it's driven by celebrity. Mm-hmm. And celebrity is only the very tip of the entertainment business. Really, the entertainment business is hard workers, producers, directors, writers, people that work on sets all over the world. So that perception is so wrong, and it's not a business that has egomaniacs, as some people are depicted. It has to be a team business. You can't make a movie unless everybody is working together. Mm-hmm. Just like you can't do a canoe trip. You know, you go on a canoe trip, and if you're not working together, you end up with no tents pitched, no dinner cooked, sleeping bags wet in a storm, and misery. The only way not to have misery is to work together.
Well, one of the you know, you talk about the integrity of the people involved at the corporate level, all the way up top to bottom. And I don't think anybody doubts that. But if you take a look at Disney, for instance, one of the questions that arises about corporate power is the amount of concentration of wealth and power in the entertainment industry. Disney owns ABC, it owns ESPN. Consolidation in the news business and the media business has a lot of people concerned. That's done for profit. It may not be done. And what the concern is, I'll express this to you, is that we may not be getting enough of the truth. There may not be enough sources for truth if so much power is concentrated in the hands of a few media people. It's good for business, not good for democracy. How would you respond to that?
Well, I hate to sound like, you know, being on an interview and disagreeing with everything you say feels like Tom Cruise.
Well, I'm not saying
that louder.
I'm reflecting public opinion.
Well, it's completely incorrect. There are more avenues today than in the history of the universe that reach the public. When I started, there were three networks, period. Before that, there was only movie theaters, pre-1948. Then came cable, satellite television, NPR, CNN, Fox News, blogging. The amount of available information to the public is the opposite of what you projected, which is a consolidation. Yes, there's some big entertainment companies. You know, one news outlet of all these 50 happens to be ABC News, and then NBC has an outlet or two. But the amount of additional voices in every market, both on radio and television, and now with satellite radio coming, is mind-boggling. So for the first time, in my recollection, you have a major news outlet that is almost dedicated to the conservative side of the equation in the Fox story. Mm-hmm. So consolidation is frankly the opposite of what you project, and it only allows you to American companies who make movies and television shows to compete effectively in the highly expensive, high-end television and motion pictures that other countries are now competing with Americans in. So mm-hmm. I'm going to be retiring from this consolidated company that I helped build, and probably we'll be dealing in a less consolidated world, but I still respect the fact that consolidation has been good.
Disney CEO Michael Eisner is my guest this hour. You can join us by calling 800-989-TALK. Billy has done that from Louisville. Hi, Billy.
Hi.
Do you have a question for Mr. Eisner?
Yes, I do. Mr. Eisner, it seems that Disney's bread and butter had been the movie musical, Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast. Why is it that they've strayed so far from that, and are they ever planning to return to it?
Well, the fact of the matter is we did five or six of those in a row. We thought we should move in other directions, although we did certainly movie musicals that weren't animation, and we certainly did Broadway musicals. Mm-hmm. We have the first new one coming back this fall called Chicken Little. So the answer is no, we haven't. And we've also had a relationship with Pixar, which has been doing, you know, Monsters, Inc. and Nemo and toys and so forth. So the company has been distributing this kind of product, and I think effectively, but it, you know, like anything else, the audience wants new and different and changes all the time, and we're trying to be, you know, you don't always succeed, but we're trying to be creative and original.
Thanks for the call, Billy. You know, you've had quite a tenure at Disney, and you built it from a company that had about $2 billion to something over $65 billion now, and that's quite an accomplishment. A lot of that happened, it seemed, in the first 10 years or so, and then things began to change for you and for Disney. What was different in those two sort of sets of time for you?
Well, it certainly wasn't 10 years. I mean, that's the, again, kind of a cliche. We prior to 9/11, the country was going into a recession. Up till about 2000, we had tremendous growth with, you know, Animal Kingdom and Walt Disney World and Euro Disney and a second theme park in Tokyo and a second theme park in Anaheim. And we acquired Capital Cities ABC, so we grew with ESPN. So the idea that the company had a great first 10 years and then fell apart is again, erroneous. The recession going into 9/11 obviously created for all companies, and then 9/11, particularly for our company and tourism, hit us hard. We also came to the end of a creative streak in Lion King that was unprecedented, although we picked that up with our Pixar relationship. We came out of 9/11. It took about a year and a half or 2 years for the country to recover, for tourism to come back, for places like New York and other cities that attract big tourists, Orlando, for instance. We are now back stronger than ever, record earnings. ABC, after we bought ABC, they were coming off being number one, and they were in the position that NBC now is, and ABC is now booming.
Tell you what, we're going to take a little break. We're talking with Disney Chairman Michael Eisner about his career from a happy camper to the head of the Magic Kingdom. And if you have questions, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Send us an email at TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington. Neil Conan returns tomorrow. In his two decades at the helm of Disney Corporation, Michael Eisner has presided over landmark mergers, a string of box office hits, and some flops, and sometimes rocky relationships with the board of directors. He'll leave the post as head of the mouse this fall, and he's here with us today to take a look back through his long career. If you have any questions for Michael Eisner, his influences, his career, his next steps, give us a call at 800-989-TALK, email address TOTN at NPR.org. Michael Eisner, you know, you were talking about the changing landscape and how difficult it is to kind of stay on top in a field as complicated as entertainment. Tell us a little bit about the Miramax deal and you know, why that was good for Disney and how it changed, or if it was good for Disney.
Well, it was good for Disney. It was again, excellent for Disney, and Miramax and the Weinstein brothers are very talented, and they were making very inexpensive films that were doing very well, from the Shakespeare's in Love to the Pulp Fictions to the Crying Game, etc. And they actually had a longer relationship with a major studio than most independents or any independent has ever had before. Mm. And it came to a point when we were spending too much money on movies, and they wanted to make much bigger movies, and we were already making big movies with Touchstone, that we have a very amicable, over-reported separation. Mm. But, you know, these kinds of things are not that different, actually, than relationships you have in school and camp and everywhere. And obviously, I learned a lot about this stuff and have written a lot about it in this book I wrote on camp.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to realize what's great about this camp I wrote about, Key Wayden, and it's about how every kid is wired differently, and you can succeed at camp where you can't necessarily succeed always at school. You know, we've all been there and not picked on the sports team or not got the greatest SATs or whatever. Camp, you don't fail. So when you're dealing with relationships and you get some positive influence, you get some confidence, and then you have some understanding about other people, whether the people 30 years later are the Miramax brothers or people, directors, or boards of directors or stockholders, everybody is slightly different, and you have to have respect for what they are and deal with them in a different way.
Well, tell us about, getting back to the book that you wrote on camp, Wabus, for instance. I mean, that seems to me an example of somebody who's going to have to deal with some very big differences and figure out how that plays out.
Well, here's a man who's actually, his name is Alfred Hare, and they named him Wabus because that's the Algonquin word for rabbit, but... He and his predecessor in the turn of the last century understood about these kids being wired differently and you don't fail summer camp and how to help the other fellow. A very contemporary, I mean, Mel Levine at the University of North Carolina, that previously in Harvard, has written books about all kinds of minds, and I'm interested in what he's written. And ironically, he has come to, in a very scientific, educated way, what these men came to in an instinctual way 100 years ago, which is basically respect each individual for what they can contribute, reinforce them. If you can't hike, you can canoe. If you can't canoe, you can play tennis. If you can't play tennis, you can play baseball. That is the opposite of the way most people look at kids that are different.
Mm-hmm.
And this environment interested me because I deal so much in the interpersonal world. And for me, yes, I was influenced by my family. I was influenced by my Midwestern college I went to, Denison University in Ohio. But I was mostly influenced because I was a staff there as well as camper.
Hmm.
And as a staff at 16 and 17, you're acting out as an adult. You're taking kids into the wilderness and bringing them back safely. You don't get that kind of authority until you're in your 30s. Because in my 20s, I was Xeroxing, I was getting people coffee,
mm-hmm.
and I was learning. But in my 18, 17, right. 16, I was actually doing things that gave me confidence that I could do things later.
Let's go out to Prescott, Arizona. Angie's on the line. Hi, Angie.
Hi.
You have a question for us?
Yes, I was wondering, Mr. Eisner, what you would identify as being early in your career, maybe late 20s, early 30s, a turning point or a foundation for your success later on?
Well, I did. I mean, I was at ABC, and I recognized two things. One, quality was unbelievably important, and two, profitability was important. People that only talked about quality and didn't turn it into profits didn't last, and I thought people that didn't talk about quality or act in a quality way, they also didn't last. So the early things that I was allowed to do, because ABC was young and I was young, was I really put together the ABC daytime schedule with All My Children and Days of Our Lives and General Hospital, which had already been on the air, but the other two I put on the air. I worked in the children's schedule with the Jackson 5 and the Osmond Brothers and things like that. And I learned pretty early about how to take risks, where to make big mistakes, and where to strive for excellence. And I think it happened to me by watching others who around me either only going for profits are only going for, I don't know, headlines,
mm-hmm.
and not kind of putting them together. So I did have although I think my experience at camp really was the foundation for wanting to do things in a better way because of this dogma, this kind of religious dogma about the environment and about don't drag your canoe and treat everybody with respect. It kind of stuck with me.
But how do you do that in a practical way? I mean, you do have responsibility for profits. You've got people with their own ideas. And in the end, you know, and a lot of the criticism that you received had to do with the sense of you being, your response was, well, it's going to cost us too much. We can't do that. We're not heading in that direction. So you've got to weigh the cost of a good idea, you know, against its likelihood of turning a profit.
Well, I've been criticized for both. We spent $11 billion on our theme park business in the course of 5 or 6 years to put a moat around our theme park business to make Walt Disney World and Disneyland the most incredible places where nobody could ever compete. So I was criticized by spending too much money, and then other times I'm criticized by not spending enough. The fact of the matter is, in the American system, unless you're profitable, you're not allowed to do anything good, bad, or indifferent. So you have to be profitable. But profitability at any cost is dangerous, and it's dooming. The people at Enron and the likes were going for profitability at any cost. That was an economic accounting disaster. People that make products, movies or toys or television shows that go the low road, they may have short-term profits, but they end up going out of business because they have no respect for the audience. It really is a marriage of common sense. And sometimes you squeeze to be efficient and take the friction out of costs and not overpay. And other times you realize to make Pirates of the Caribbean that much better, you got to go the extra mile.
Well, that's right along those lines. We have an email from Sarah in Chautauqua who says, if there's any value in corporate life or culture for individual contributors versus the good team player, as you know, many who work for Enron or Arthur Andersen. You know, what about the person who says the team is going in the wrong direction? They're the voice in the wilderness.
Well, if this is Chautauqua, New York, which I assume it is.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Well, that's where my wife is from. So Chautauqua is a very good example of quality and excellence in that entire Chautauqua Foundation. And she presents a very interesting question, because this was the problem in Watergate. This was the problem in Enron. This is the problem on the bad side, and it can be the problem on the good side. People tend to follow their leader or their leaders. They tend to want to please their leader or leaders. And if the leader or leaders are sending them into a suspicious area, they often tend to go along. If a leader is on the right area, they also go along that way. So how does an individual stand up to a leader that's going the wrong way? Well, that individual has to have a lot of guts, because it's very hard and it's against human nature. And those that do it, that aren't just doing it for revenge, should be respected.
Of course, the other side of that is, what do you do if you're the, you know, you're the CEO and you hear this person? How do you weigh that when you've got the sort of pressures of running the company?
Well, this is the emperor's new clothes. If you're the CEO, what you want to hear, people may not believe this, is the truth. The biggest problem for a CEO is everybody telling him he's got the same color socks on, when in fact they do, that one's blue and one's brown. A CEO only is as good as the veracity from the people that work for him. And he has to create a culture of, tell me where we're screwing up. Tell me where the canoe is heading in the wrong direction, or into a hurricane, or into whatever. And if you don't have that environment, it won't work. And whatever may be said about the Disney company, our management could have never lasted for 21 years if we weren't listening to all the people that work for us. Now, everybody's not right. If somebody gives you a piece of information and you have to explain to them that that is why we're doing it, and I'm sorry, but thank you very much. But often, you don't see the forest through the trees unless people point it out to you.
Yeah, but now you've been criticized for hiring Michael Ovitz for just that reason, that here's a guy who you could get along with.
Well, I've been criticized for hiring Michael Ovitz because I made a mistake, and whoever criticized me for it is 100% right. But the, you know, and if you don't make a mistake in business and in life, and if you don't take risks, you're never going to succeed. Our president had died. I had a bypass operation. I was looking for somebody that I could trust who knew the entertainment business well. And I hired Michael Ovitz. And that turned out to be a mistake. A large mistake, and unfortunately, because Disney is so public, a very public mistake. The same year that Michael Ovitz didn't work out, there were 90 companies who within a year had let their CEO or their president go. It just was very visible because he was so representing, you know, Robert Redford and a lot of other people, Dustin Hoffman, a lot of people before he came to us. But what can I say? If you criticize me for making a bad movie and it's a bad movie, you're right. If you criticize for a bad hire, you're right. But generally, over time, I think we've done better than we've done worse.
Disney CEO Michael Eisner is my guest. We'll go out to Springfield, Illinois. John is on the line. Hi, John.
Hello. Michael, I was a staff member at Keewaydin in the 60s, and both my children went there. One of my fondest memories were all the traditions at Keewaydin that still influence me. I was wondering how you feel the traditions gave you strength or insight in your business dealings.
I guess I'm not allowed to ask your last name, so maybe I even know you. But the fact of the matter is, all those cliches, those traditions, the four winds ceremony, the board about don't do this and do that, all those cliches actually at Keewaydin are kind of a Ten Commandments of Keewaydin. And they, even though you can't follow them all the time, they do create the backbone for a future life. And that's why I was saying earlier that the parallel between Disney and Keewaydin is so amazing to me, because both institutions have traditions, have a certain respect for their either their customers or their employees or whatever. And I found that at Keewaydin, and obviously, where do you live? Maybe I can figure out who you are.
I live in Illinois now.
That doesn't help me. Okay, nice to talk to you.
John, thank you.
And I think we did meet, yes.
Thank you very much for the call, John. We're talking with Disney CEO Michael Eisner. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio, sitting in for Neil Conan, and Michael Eisner has written a book about his experiences at Camp Keewaydin as a young man. You know, there's a story there, too, about a Waboos who kind of gets a nudge. This is his initiation, I guess, and invites you to box against a nine-year-old boy. Tell us about the boxing incident.
Well, my father, who had gone to Keewaydin, had been a camper with this Waboos, a.k.a. Alfred Hare, took me to Keewaydin for a weekend when I was seven. And without boring you, I ended up boxing in a ring somebody who I thought was like Muhammad Ali. Actually, he was only eight. But that was my initial experience. I never boxed. I'd never seen boxing, I don't think. And there I was being initiated into boxing. I think after 10 seconds, my father thought maybe this was probably not a good idea. But I lasted about 30. And these are big, fat gloves. I mean, nobody gets hurt. But my pride was questioned, although I didn't know anybody.
Yeah, is this one of these things where you sort of found out a little more about yourself after the whole thing was over?
I think I found out more about my father.
Did he push you into these sort of things? I mean, did he think that this was going to make a man out of you?
Let me put it this way. After World War II, my father started an airline in Ecuador. So my father was an adventurer, an entrepreneur. Now, Howard, you started an airline called TWA. My father started Air Ecuador. I think they got it backwards. but now my father was a pretty much of a fantastic character.
Yeah. Did he? I mean, do you think you you sort of lived up to his expectations, or did you always feel that you were a little short of his expectations?
Well, like most sons, I think if I didn't get the grades at school that he had anticipated I would get, he would be disappointed, or I didn't do one thing or other. I mean, he was extremely kind, but when he's your father, 8 feet tall, seemingly, you want to succeed for your father. And I think my father lived to see me on the cover of Time magazine, so I think even though we had a lot of conflict in high school, like every son and every father. Mm-hmm. I think I recovered before it was over.
Let's go out to Cheyenne, Wyoming. Ron's on the line. Hi, Ron.
Hello. Ron Wales here, Cheyenne, Wyoming. I'm formerly a resident of Orlando, and it's kind of hard to gauge the impact of Disney on the world when you live in a community like that. But Mr. Eisner, what would you consider your contributions to Disney to be and your legacy? And what do you feel the future direction of Disney's canoe is going to be, to use your metaphor?
Ooh, thank you,
well,
Ron.
I think... Bob Iger, who's the CEO-elect, is a good sternman, a good trip leader, to keep the metaphor going. I think we have made in Orlando the most incredible, adding the studio tour, the Animal Kingdom, 30,000 hotel rooms, major architects, probably the best hotels in the world, fabulous service. Now you don't even have to pick up your bags at the Orlando airport. We deliver them right to your room. The Disney cruise ship's there in Orlando. We have created that and a mini of that in Anaheim and in Paris and Japan and soon in Hong Kong. I think we, not me alone, the whole company, we saw that this brand was a piece of people's minds the Disney brand is a piece of people's minds, everybody's mind, all over the world. Keewaydin is a piece of 1,000 people's mind. So it's just a different scope. But what we did is we, frankly, Disney from the museum and back into the marketplace.
Got about 30. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think Bob Iger and the executives that are in place will continue that strategy, and also they will move Disney more internationally, and I think they will more deal with the technological world that we exist in and find new ways to deliver products ubiquitously everywhere.
All right, you got 20 seconds. What's next?
Well, what's next? My wife... When we asked the two people that went around the world in a solo flight on one engine what they were going to do next, because they were at Disneyland having dinner, they said, we're going to Disneyland. So I think I'll take. And we made that a my wife's idea turned into our marketing campaign for 20 years. So I would be remiss if I didn't say next Disneyland.
Michael Eisner, CEO of Walt Disney Company, stepping down September 30th. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.